From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we are very thankful for every one of you. If your New Year's resolution is to make sure people are engaged in constructive interreligious dialogue, please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. This broadcast is supported in part by the Rudin Family Foundation. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Folk who are talking about having Mall Monday in Georgia. Yeah. There's a group talking about one in Alabama. Yeah. The Daily Tar Heel called and said, can you tell us about the Mall Monday breaking out in New York City? Yeah. You have put a spotlight on injustice in this nation.
As we enter a new year, it's important that we take some time to sort through priorities. Without that, all too often, the weeks and months rush by and we find ourselves reacting to whatever seems urgent moment to moment. But what about the big picture? The potential for sustainable progress? What are the most urgent areas calling for social justice and change at the beginning of this year? In these first weeks of 2014, we're going to bring you some of the voices that we feel particularly optimistic about. Now, these are leaders and activists that, frankly, you may not have heard of yet, but you will. Mainstream media thrives on conflict and controversy, often to the exclusion of content and context. We at State of Belief try to go deeper, to engage in constructive dialogue across lines of religious belief and political affiliation, because we really do believe that the answers we all need are found only in the aggregate, not in partisan or denominational silos. And so this week, we introduce a four-week series titled A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, where we're going, how we'll get there. And we're going to highlight the powerful witness of the Reverend William Barber, head of the North Carolina NAACP and founder of the ever-expanding Moral Monday movement.
Unconditional war on poverty in America.
War on poverty.
The war on poverty.
Vicious cycle of poverty.
LBJ, of course, was a Democrat. These are Republicans, using the milestone to argue LBJ's big government battle plan, which created Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps, has not fully worked.
As we mark the 50th anniversary of President Johnson's declaring America's war on poverty, too many voices are echoing Ronald Reagan's words claiming the war has been lost. I want to challenge that claim. And more importantly, I want to look to where leadership in the most important struggles against economic inequality is coming from today. I've got some more to say about that, and I will do it toward the end of the show. But first,
Utah became the 18th state where same-sex marriage is legal when a federal judge struck down that state's ban. But today, the Supreme Court blocked any more same-sex marriage weddings in Utah, while the judge's ruling is being appealed.
And now State Governor Gary Herbert has announced that same-sex marriages performed before Tuesday's halt will not be recognized.
It was only last week that we were marking the milestone of a judge's ruling making Utah the 18th state to permit marriage equality. While acknowledging the legal challenges that were coming, we celebrated, along with Nicole Christensen, a young Mormon living in Salt Lake City, who was one of the very first to marry a same-sex partner as soon as the ruling came down, as many as 1,000 couples tied the knot on those first heady days in late December. On this week's show, we'll follow up with Nicole Christensen, but right now, I'm very happy to welcome back to State of Belief Radio Dr. Joanna Brooks, Joanna's a national voice on Mormon life and politics. Joanna, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief.
Reverend, it's always a pleasure.
Oh, gosh, a lot's happened in a very short amount of time.
Those were heady days. That was quite a Christmas present for progressive Mormons.
I think it's fair to say that December the 20th ruling in favor of marriage took most of us by surprise. Has anything that's happened since then been anything other than you expected?
No. When we're talking about the state of Utah, we're talking about certainly one of the most politically conservative states in the union. And we're also talking about a state with a majority population of conservative people of faith. No one expected Utah to be among the first third of the states in the nation to legalize gay marriage. So the state's appeals and their requests for a stay are, I think, totally to be expected.
Is there a different way that this could have happened that would have been more palatable to you?
As a person of faith, I always look to the long game. and I know a lot of gay and lesbian couples who were married in Utah and their allies are, you know, disappointed that the U.S. Supreme Court did issue the stay. They are even more disappointed or angered or upset by Governor Gary Herbert instructed state agencies to not recognize, to not offer services that would be offered to legally married straight couples to the couples married during the two-week window at the end of December and beginning of January. Mm-hmm. So that's a grave disappointment that the governor, but not a surprise that the governor is taking an aggressively hardline stance. But, you know, observers of the U.S. Supreme Court say that there are some procedural hints in the way that Justice Sotomayor, who received the request for the stay, handled it, that suggests that the court may be preparing to hear the Utah case as one that will, you know, set a precedent for other states in the nation, and that is a very significant storyline in the making.
Would you welcome that?
Well, it would certainly be. I mean, I'm someone who believes that God loves irony, that God loves surprises. It would certainly, you know, look, the issue of same-sex marriage is defining contemporary Mormonism. The Mormon Church has been deeply committed to fighting the legalization of civil same-sex marriages since the early 1990s. They've invested heavily in that fight at every level, from top leadership down to some very, very, what they'd see as heroic sacrifices made by conservative people at the rank and file, both in terms of personal time and even personal resources, large donations asked of them by church leaders in the Proposition 8 campaign, for example, in California. Mormon people have really invested in this fight, and it's one that has theological significance for LDS people, too. You know, marriage occupies a place in Mormon theology unlike in other Christian faiths. It's a saving rite. It's akin to baptism, really. Only Mormon couples married in LDS temples are allowed to access the highest levels of heaven. And marriage between a man and a woman is seen as an emulation of the nature of God, which in our tradition is a heavenly father and a heavenly mother. So, you know, there is a deep practical, political, economic, and theological investment in marriage among Mormon people. So if the Utah case were the one that were to go to the Supreme Court, it would be deeply ironic and robustly significant.
Where does this leave the roughly 1,000 newly married same-gender couples in Utah?
For those of us who support marriage equality, those were some very beautiful days. I mean, we're talking about rural counties, rural religious people, rural religious gays and lesbians coming out of the shadows of their communities, going down to the county clerk and being able to declare their love publicly. I heard reports from progressive Mormons who were passing out flowers to couples waiting for their licenses in rural Tooele County, Utah, west of Salt Lake City, talking about women who met at church girls camp 30 years before and had waited all these years to finally be able to tie the knot and be legal in the eyes of the state. Mormons are a family-loving people. We are marriage-loving people. So those days meant so much to gay and lesbian Mormons at the grassroots and to their allies. Understandably, right now, folks are feeling disappointed, heartbroken, threatened, upset with the state for spending its resources to destroy families. But they can take heart from couples in California, Washington, you know, other states where marriages have been recognized for short periods of time and then not recognized and then recognized again.
Yeah. You talk beautifully about the importance of marriage in the Mormon tradition. What's the difference between you and leaders in the Mormon church who are so opposed to this?
Well, that's a really important question. Over and over again, the leaders of the church have expressed concern over issues of religious freedom. Mm-hmm. They've expressed a concern that should same-sex marriages be legal civilly, mm-hmm. that the Mormon church will come under unbearable pressure to solemnize those marriages in their temples. And this is a message that's been communicated down to the rank and file. And you ask rank and file, you know, conservative, faithful, good Mormon people, and they'll say, well, I'm concerned that the government's going to come in and close down the Mormon temple if same-sex marriage is civilized. And we know this is not legally a sound argument. Mm-hmm. We know that, for example, in the state of Massachusetts, same-sex marriage has been legal for 10 years. Has the Mormon temple in Boston been shut down because it's not compliant? Yeah. No. We know that the Constitution guarantees religious freedoms that will protect Mormon theological practices of marriage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't always know what is preventing the leadership of the LDS Church from welcoming the state's recognition of the dignity and sanctity of same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that. I just know what folks at the grassroots are expressing in terms of fear.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And if you ask me the same question about my tradition, I would have to answer the same way. The only other thing I would say probably is our tradition has always been hung up on anything related to sex, and this gets really close there.
I don't know that we're free of that either, but I do think, you know, the way that marriage is sacralized in Mormonism, where it is viewed as a saving rite and as an emulation of the nature of God, is a key part of the picture. Another is the long history, though, too, of Mormons that dates back to the 19th century of our distinctive marriage practices, and back in those days, that was polygamy coming under attack from the outside world. So when Mormons contemplate the legalization of same-sex marriage civilly across the country and see a future of themselves as a minority holdout, they're hearkening back to that feeling of embattlement and siege that dates for us the 19th century.
Yes. Do you think, whether overtly or implicitly, the Mormon Church is involved in this pushback?
When the judge's decision was initially announced on the 20th of December, the church very quickly issued a statement affirming its commitment to the sanctity of heterosexual-only marriage. It's been fairly quiet in the days following, although we do know that, according to the Salt Lake Tribune, the state of Utah has involved other law firms beyond its own legal department in pressing for a stay with the U.S. Supreme Court. The Salt Lake Tribune did not report who, but I would not be surprised if firms with influential and powerful Mormon people were involved in preparing the state's case.
Where does this leave lay members who respect the church but are likely to have LGBT family members or friends?
Well, one thing we've seen, you know, reported time and time again in the days following the December 20th legalization of gay marriage in Utah is wonderful reports from the rank and file of, you know, very traditional, very observant conservative Mormon people reaching out to family and friends who were among the first to get in line at the county clerk and expressing their love and support and respect. We've heard stories of folks getting together to throw wedding receptions for couples who have been waiting decades to marry, even though it's not in keeping with the strictest tenets of the faith. Mormons have a wonderful capacity to love and serve one another. And, you know, we're getting a lot of wonderful stories from the grassroots about Mormon family members who, us being a marrying people, are glad to be able to see their relatives tie the knot in the eyes of the state.
So now,
everyone's going to reassess and recalibrate, and I hope settle in for the long haul on what could be a potentially far-reaching decision from the U.S. Supreme Court if this case comes to hearing.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. And, Joanna, you expected, as you said, this pushback and didn't know exactly what form it would take. So I feel comfortable asking, what do you expect next? Is this a long, drawn-out matter, or is this something that's going to move through the courts rather quickly?
Well, I think the movement towards marriage equality across the country has, I think, stunned many of us with its speed. It boggles my mind to think that it was just 5 years ago we were fighting Proposition 8 out here in California where mm-hmm. I live. Mm-hmm. With all that has happened since then, there's been a sea change. The Circuit Court of Appeals will hear arguments from the state of Utah starting this March. There could be a decision over the summer that would potentially set up for an appeal to the Supreme Court. If it's accepted, it could be heard next calendar year. So mm-hmm. legal observers are saying there could be something by June 2015, even though the court usually prefers to take a very incremental approach.
Yeah.
I think we do need to settle in for the long haul, but also be prepared for surprises because the movement on gay and lesbian issues is happening so fast that stay tuned.
Yes, yes. You know you're good at this.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Joanna Brooks is an award-winning scholar of religion and public life and a senior correspondent at Religion Dispatches. She's the author of The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. Joanna, thank you always for being with us on State of Belief, and today is no exception to that. You've helped us.
Thank you. My pleasure, and my best to your listeners.
You remember Nicole Christensen? She was on our show last week. Nicole married her partner Natalie in Salt Lake City on the same day a judge's ruling made Utah the 18th state to allow marriage equality. Nicole spoke to us, sharing the significance of getting married and a cautious optimism as to what lies ahead. Now, with the Supreme Court halting marriages to allow for an appeal to go forward, and the governor of Utah saying that he will not enforce the marriages that have been performed, I wanted to check back in with Nicole for a first-person take on what all of this is doing to the people of Utah who are most directly affected, the couples themselves. Nicole, it's very generous of you to come back on with us. I thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
What has this week been like for you and Natalie?
It feels like a roller coaster that we can't get off of, honestly. It is such an emotional up and down. One minute they're saying there's a stay. The next minute the governor's saying our marriages are, quote unquote, on hold until further notice. And, you know, nothing can extinguish the joy I feel about marrying my wife. And, you know, that will always hold true. I have the marriage license framed in my living room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that to me is very real and very tangible.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the politics surrounding it is just honestly exhausting.
When you and your wife have talked about this, do you talk about it negatively, humorously, very seriously, with a lot of anxiety? How are your conversations?
It's almost taken kind of a dark humor to it. We were joking that, you know, we should change our Facebook status to "it's complicated" because honestly, it's the twists and turns of it are just so dizzying. But, you know, we're trying to keep a light heart about it, and we're trying to stay positive because we know that in the end the judicial system will run its course, and, you know, we're on the right side of history, and, you know, we just have to stay positive.
Well, I could not forget the optimism that was in your voice last week. And I remember asking you before we got off of that interview if you thought there would be much pushback against this. And understandably, you said you thought not much, and certainly that the church would stay out of it for the most part. Do you then see these latest events as just a temporary bump in the road, or do they represent serious threats?
You know, I have a lot of optimism, you know, going into this, and, you know, perhaps my lens was too rosy-hued, but, you know, the way I see it from my perspective now, that this is just another bump in the road, and that Governor Herbert is on the wrong side of history, and that he's just fighting a losing battle. They're saying that Utah's going to dump $2 million into fighting this, and I predict it will be much more than that. And, you know, that money at the end of the day will be money wasted, because marriage equality is going to march on, and I don't think that, you know, that is something that's up for debate.
Is any of that money likely now to come from the Latter-day Saints Church?
You know, I stand by what I said before. I don't think the Mormon Church will be pouring any money into the legal fight this time. I think that it's going to stay very, you know, transparent with the state, using all their money to, you know, fight it and that kind of thing. But, you know, at the same time, the influence of the church on this proceeding is definitely very real and very felt, especially this week.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that what you most want to hear is there a solution to this problem, and the court gets out of the way and you all go on with your marriage. But I think there's probably a need for you to hear from your friends and your family to help you get through this time. And I wish you'd be just very specific with me in saying what you need from people who want to support you.
You know, for people to honestly say, your marriage is real, your marriage is just like anyone else's, it is a binding contract between you and your spouse and a promise that you made to each other, and that's all that matters. The legal details will all be worked out, and they're all kind of background noise, but we support you, and we are there for you, and we recognize that you two are married no matter what the state says, no matter what the governor says, no matter what the church says. So that is really what I need to hear right now from my friends and, you know, people that are allies.
Are you hearing some of that?
Absolutely. My friends all this week have been, you know, texting me and calling me and saying, you know, I'm so sorry about the troubles that you're going through. And I say, you know, it's just a bump in the road. We'll get there, you know, one way or another.
Nicole, I really do respect the way you're handling this. I'm not sure that I would handle it as well as you're doing. I hope it is a very brief delay on the road to fairness and equality. And I hope that you and Natalie will feel the support you need every day to continue this. I thank you again for being with us this time, and I wish you and Natalie only the best in your life together. And maybe very soon we'll be back on and saying how happy we are that the marriage is going to last legally. I know it's going to last morally, but that it will be lasting legally as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
On this show, we frequently celebrate bold new initiatives for justice and interreligious action. We also highlight successful programs and organizations who've made a significant mark. But it's at least as important to study the process. How does an inspired vision become a growing and influential movement? We've been very fortunate to be able to track the increasing success of Moral Monday, the brainchild of North Carolina NAACP head, the Reverend William Barber, which has brought growing numbers of people together who are willing to devote the time and even be arrested to highlight the inequalities facing them, their friends, and neighbors in that state and beyond. As we inaugurate our new series titled A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, where we're going, how we'll get there, it seems only right to revisit Moral Monday. That's why we are replaying the interview that we had with him not very long ago.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you and with your listening audience.
Reverend Barber, I left the National NAACP conference to return to North Carolina when this verdict was read, and you were quoted as saying, "Let's stand our ground.
I needed to be back at Mall Monday because I needed to see a community of people, black and white, Latino, who still believe in humanity. I really came back for my own healing. And I testified. And in the midst of speaking to them, I said, we need to stand our ground on things like repealing stand your ground laws. We need to stand our ground against violence. We need to stand our ground and push for laws that outlaw racial profiling. We need to stand our ground against all forms of violence. You know, as Coretta Scott King said, you know, keeping children in poverty is a form of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Producing more guns is a form of violence. Taking kids to education, healthcare is a form of violence. We need to stand our ground and believe in a humanity and the possibility for humanity to be different than what is being portrayed by these folk that are so afraid of something that all they can think of is their answer to every problem is cut taxes, make the poor more responsible, and give people more guns.
Right.
We need to stand our ground against that kind of philosophy. We must stop this proliferation of guns. We've gone gun crazy.
Mm.
Our legislature in North Carolina, this is what they've decided to do, for instance, at our state capitol. They denied 500,000 people access to Medicaid, poor people, poor children, 170,000 people unemployment. They've kicked 30,000 kids off of preschool, poor kids, raised taxes on 900,000 poor people to give 23 families a tax credit, a tax break, attack voting rights, and then pass bills to put more guns in the street, allow guns in places where there's liquor being served, to allow guns on college campuses. So they've gone gun crazy. It's almost like we're in like on Star Trek, we're in some kind of extremist warp, an alternative universe that doesn't even line up with our deepest moral values and our deepest constitutional values. So what I want to see is us be a catalyst for a new moral conversation, not liberal versus conservative, not Republican versus Democrat, but what is immoral versus what is moral, what is extreme versus what is constitutional, a conversation about our common humanity, a conversation about the common good. And in that conversation, we say we're not going to commit attention violence against the poor. We're not going to pass laws to promote policies that hurt and damage the least among us. We're not going to promote policies that actually uphold violence and promote violence as the answer to everything. And particularly the guns, we want to roll back the access to assault weapons. We want to repeal these stand your ground laws in North Carolina and everywhere else. And we want to pass laws that end racial profiling. We've got to come back to our senses. I think too many people, the way I describe it, have become drunk on this Tea Party tea.
Mm-hmm.
and they're under the influence of Coke, KOCH.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to come back to our senses in this country, particularly down in the South.
You know, you could be charged with talking like a sane man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
listen.
I hope so.
Well, no, it is so good to hear you elaborate those values and know that you're calling people back to them. How are you organizing around this? We got a good introduction to Moral Mondays, which is just a phenomenal concept. How else are you organizing to do what you just talked about?
Well, let me give you one piece about Moral Monday.
And
this is, we've been organizing for 7 years, and one of the things you're seeing in North Carolina with this new legislature that decided to be like the George Wallace of the 21st century in extreme is they're actually reacting to our victory. We organized for 7 years, put something together called the Historic Thousand of Jones Street People's Coalition, more than 150 organizations with 100 branches of the NAACP. We formed an anti-racist, anti-poverty, pro-justice coalition with the moral values and constitutional values at the center of it. And inside of 7 years, we passed some of the most progressive voting laws. We passed in the South a law called the Racial Justice Act that addressed the issue of race being used in the application of the death penalty, progressive educational policies. We pushed through and one of my senators to support Obamacare, Affordable Health Care Act. Mm-hmm. But then this group, there was a reaction in 2010, and they came in. And now what they're attempting to do is go backwards. As I said, in the first 50 days, my friend, they decided to hurt 500,000 poor people, Medicaid, 170,000 mm-hmm. people who had unemployment, and 900,000 people who were getting an earned income tax credit that even Ronald Reagan said was good. It's almost as though they have a premeditated desire mm-hmm. to just go backwards as fast as possible. So that's why on 8th and April, 17 of us went in and said, "We, this is immoral, this is extreme, this is bad public policy. It's constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane." We didn't know what would happen. But we knew we had to stand, and we had to stand in the deepest tradition of the nonviolent legacy because we had tried everything else. And from that, we went from 17 getting arrested to now over 850 people. Thousands have shown up every Monday. We now have over 600,000 hits on our social media. We're doing massive voter registration, voter education. We have a legal team, the Southern Coalition for Justice and Advancement Project, out of D.C., both organizing with us and examining every piece of policy against the Constitution, both state and federal. And we have directly attacked the pharisaical heresy of the far Christian right mm-hmm. that attempts to limit moral discussions to abortion, prayer in the school, and where you stand on issues like homosexuality. Which, when I read my Bible, Old and New Testament, even if those things are mentioned, they are not the predominant moral issues of the Scripture. The predominant right. moral issues are, how do you treat the poor?
Right.
How do you love people? How do you deal with economic justice? How do you treat people on the margins? And how do you treat people, even if they're different from you, how do you find a way, as Deuteronomy said, to still respect them and protect them as your brothers and sisters?
Yeah. My guest is Moral Monday founder, the Reverend William Barber. We're featuring his work in this first installment of a four-part series titled A Prophetic Vision for a New Year. Where we're going, how we'll get there. How can we change mindsets and perspectives? This came up a lot during the trial because people talked about the perspective from which you were looking at it. How can we change that so that the majority of Americans have some basic sensitivity to what life is like in this country for people who aren't like them?
Well, you need a long-term, I believe, consistent moral movement like we're seeing happening in North Carolina that shapes people's consciousness and calls people together in new ways. You know, every Monday at Mall Monday, you know, let me point out to your audience a miracle. The NAACP in the South was often an organization that many, many white people were taught to hate and fear. And yet every Monday, under the banner of the NAACP, if you have 5,000 people there, 50% of them are white. 50%. When I came back last week, the white women in the audience had Trayvon Martin stickers on. The white women in the South now. When I went to the NAACP, my general minister and president, Sharon Watkins, came over to the NAACP's convention, because we were in the same building, and announced that the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which is predominantly white, 95% white, was passing a emergency resolution to stand with the NAACP to call for a civil rights investigation of the Zimmerman verdict.
Hmm.
Boy. So when we come together and we destroy the myth, the white Southern strategy myth, and that is that you can somehow hurt other people without hurting yourselves, and we go directly at that with a movement that's not so much, as I said, Democrat or Republican, but calls people to a higher place, calls people to as Abraham Lincoln said, to our better angels, then that's where you begin to find hope. When last Monday, a white lady from Harnett County, and you got to understand, Harnett County is where the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan used to live. And she came up to me and said, "Reverend Barber, I was taught not to like, you know, the NAACP and such and such, but the only people fighting for us poor people, right now, fighting for our unemployment, my Medicare. She told me how her brother was sick and how her other brother is unemployed, is the NAACP. And then she said this. She said, I brought five other members of my family, and we're all going to jail. This will be it. We've never done this in our lives. She said, but I'm so sick of people tearing us apart and dividing us. We're in this together.
Mm.
I had two agnostics come to the back of the stage and ask me for prayer. Now, that was real interesting. And one of them said, you know, I was an agnostic, but I never heard these scriptures. See, they never heard Isaiah 10, woe unto those who legislate evil, right, or Luke 4, or Matthew 25, really lifted up in the circles that they've been in.
Right.
And they actually said to me, would you pray for me? And we're standing with you. And thanks for helping us rethink the whole piece about faith and about justice.
Yeah. Reverend Barber, we've got to go in just a minute here, but I want to come full circle and go back to where we started this conversation with you returning to North Carolina because of your three sons. One of the most poignant and disturbing moments for me was I read the experience of Otis Moss III in Chicago, who went home because he had children at home, and he said his son asked him, "Will I be next?"
Exactly.
You've got three sons. I've got two sons. How do you answer that question?
Well, my son said this to me, "Dad, they're trying to emasculate us all.
Yeah.
They want to take our voting rights. They want to take our lives. They want to take our educational opportunity." And I think you answer it by holding them tight. You answer it by continuing to fight against the injustices. You answer it by making sure they go around some people who do not look like them necessarily, but also who do not think about them in terms of a threat and a thug and something to be feared.
Mm-hmm.
And you answer them by saying that I think you own that pain. As I said, I went back because I needed saving again on Monday. Mm-hmm. I've tried to do the right. I've got degrees from three of the best schools. I try to follow the laws of the land. But I'm telling you, that verdict made me so afraid and so hurt and so angry that the thought ran across my mind, you know, about arming us, you know, those kinds of things.
Right.
And thinking about it in a much, and it was a moment that I felt hate that I didn't want to feel. And I know that the only thing that can save you from that sometimes is to go around a group of people that have not lost their sense of humanity to this vicious cycle of hate.
Yeah.
And so I think we all got to hold our sons a little closer, but we've also got to use this moment of pain to be more determined to fight against this senseless, constant perpetuation of violence and destruction of lives.
The Reverend William Barber is the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, the second largest in the nation. He's emerged as a leading voice for justice, as organizer of the Moral Mondays direct action movement in his state. He's a very busy man. We got him right off of a plane ride, and I'm particularly grateful that he was able to spend a few minutes with us today on State of Belief Radio. Reverend Barber, I tell you, you are an inspiration, and I am so grateful for what you do, and we will be checking in to see how it's going. Continued success in your work.
Well, God bless you, and thank you and your audience, and let us never forget Isaiah 58 that says, if we cry loud and spare not against forms of injustice and violence, that one day God will call us repairers of the breach, that it should be our mission in life. And let us, as Christians, never forget that we have been anointed for such a time as this to declare good news to the poor and hope and healing to the brokenhearted. And we must take up that mantle and trust that God will take our feeble efforts when we walk by faith to do powerful things in the earth that we live.
On next week's installment of our series of prophetic vision for a new year, where we're going, how we'll get there, I'll be talking with one of your favorites, Sister Simone Campbell. You know, I am really grateful for people like William Barber, who keep fanning the flames of compassion and refusing to give up on fighting the plagues of inequity and poverty. I must tell you that during this past week, especially on last Wednesday, as we remembered the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's prophetic declaration of a national war on poverty, I was disappointed. I was disappointed in the amount of criticism that I heard related to Johnson's initiative. As a matter of fact, to be perfectly honest with you, over the past several days, I have felt like I'm on the wrong side of the news. More than once, I've realized that I was out of step with individuals with whom I usually walk and consult. Now, maybe it's easier to criticize something that happened 50 years ago than it is to oppose something happening today. But that was not my experience this week or 50 years ago when I heard LBJ's speech. For a young seminarian who passionately believed that we could change the world, I was encouraged and thrilled to hear that the president of our nation would make a pledge to support the elimination of poverty in our country. Remember the context. The nation was still grieving the death of President Kennedy, and here from the new president was a clarion call to moral integrity, essential to nurturing community and advancing equality. Everybody could be involved in getting rid of poverty. Oh, I know some people criticize the president's choice of words, a war on poverty. They didn't like it. I don't like war either. In fact, I hate it. But LBJ spoke with authority and clarity. Those were his words. If a war on poverty was waged to an extent that eradicated poverty, great. Say what you want to about it, and let's get on with doing the work. LBJ did little in his political life that was not beneficial to him. But on this one, he spoke for people with no voices, like he did when he made the decision to pass civil rights legislation. It was an act that destroyed his credibility in certain sections of the country and exposed the economic insensitivities of other politicians. 50 years have passed, and I still passionately support an eradication of poverty. You know, another issue that has captured my attention in the past few days is the attempt of Democrats to align themselves with Pope Francis and claim, as did Bernard Sanders, a senator, independent senator from Vermont, that Democrats have a strong ally in the policy debate on economic equity. Now, personally, I happen to support the Democratic Initiative on Economic Justice. And for all of my life, I have considered economic equity to be a moral principle close to the heart of every religious leader. But when Senator Sanders said we have a strong ally in the policy debate on economic equity and mentioned the Pope, Pope Francis, I found myself raising questions, thinking, we better be very careful about what we're doing and whose authority we're leaning on or claiming. I am as concerned about Democrats attempting to co-opt the Pope as I am about Republicans having co-opted conservative religion. We live in a democracy, folks. Thankfully, we have with some success kept separate religious institutions and political institutions. Those who have criticized the right have no rationale for repeating the mistakes of the right and calling it okay because in this instance the left is involved. What the leaders of our nation do about economic inequity should come from answering the question of what is best for our nation. Neither the right nor the left should legislate on the basis of the gospel, the Torah, the Quran, or any of the other religious scriptures. You know what's interesting? Those who are praising the Pope best not tarnish his moral authority by claiming him as a kind of international K Street lobbyist. And all should be careful because an ally on one issue may turn out to be an opponent on another issue. Many of the politicians happy about the Pope were unhappy with some previous popes. President Bush, you may remember, tried to garner support for a pro-life campaign to honor a pope who died in office after a reign of pro-life declarations. Personally, yes, we do well to turn to our religious authorities as we shape our moral values. But Congress, an institution of this democracy, should turn only to the Constitution and see to it that votes are based on democratic principles, not on sectarian opinions. I guess by now you see what I mean by being on the wrong side of the news. Let's never stop thinking critically, lest we lose sight of the danger of cheering for initiatives that in reality we should be questioning. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Glad that you joined us. I'd like to thank the Rudin Family Foundation for helping to make this broadcast possible. The support of each listener is essential to keep State of Belief Radio on the air. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show. You can hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Please stay in touch with us throughout the week. You can do that on Facebook or on Twitter, both. There also is information available at stateofbelief.com. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen as well. Join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was a